You're listening to St. PDEX Season 2. Today's episode is brought to you by CapEx Advisory Group. When organizations undertake large capital or real estate projects, they turn to CapEx for additional resources and expertise. To learn what an owner's rep can do for you, visit CapEx's website at ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And by the Open Partnership Education Network, located at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. The world is open for citizens, businesses, groups, for all of us to become a smarter, better connected city by learning together. To find out more about Open, including upcoming great Aresti speakers, please visit learnopen.org. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me today on SPX is Steve Raymond, the former CEO and chairman of the board at Tech Data and the mind behind the rise of Tech Data. Currently serves on the Jabil board and the Wesco board, in both instances as chairman of the audit committees. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So I'd love to start by going back to the beginning of Tech Data. It was a company that your father owned at the time, and you came in, you know, had a dozen employees at one point and almost went on a, you know, a linear but somewhat meteoric rise over the next 10 years or so, from a couple of million in revenue into the tens of billions in revenue. So in the beginning, when you went to work with your dad, can you sort of talk about what your vision was at that point? Were you just focused on execution, or did you actually, even at that time, have designs on getting to the heights that the company did?
Well, when I started, I wasn't much more than a gopher. It was my dad's second business, which he was running part-time. He needed some help in trying to transition the model or extend the model into mail order. So I was helping build a catalog, but I really knew nothing about business, certainly nothing that would enable me to judge or assess the business as it was then, and then come up with a strategy to take it forward. The business was very different then. It was a completely different business model, doing retail distribution in the Tampa Bay area of data supplies. And over the course of time, really within about a year, we changed into a wholesale. I bought out the majority of the company from my dad first. And then we changed the model from retail distribution of things like magnetic tape and diskettes to wholesale distribution of the supplies, selling only to resellers. And then over time, began to acquire more and more product lines. So building the product and vendor portfolio, and then expanding out geographically from Florida into the Southeast, Northeast, and so on.
And so during that time, even when you say you didn't really know the business that well when you first started, but through that time on into the growth, I don't even know if you can parse these out, but was it a vision or an expectation or a feeling of bigness that was pulling you, or was it just superior execution that ultimately got you there?
I think at the time, all I wanted to do was grow the business by serving my customers as well as we could and hopefully better than others. And so I spent a lot of time in the field interviewing our customers, talking to them about their business requirements, the products they were selling, what they were looking for from a distribution partner, and then going back to the office and trying to, you know, fashion a machine that would be responsive to their needs. And that was pretty much it, because it was a time in which the computer industry was booming. All you had to do was try to catch the wave, and if you could catch it and keep on it, you were going to grow and prosper. Now, over the longer term, doing that was not sufficient. You had to refine the model and make adjustments, be more cost competitive, because margins fell by 2/3 over the course of gross margins from the time I started, say, to 4 or 5 years later. So, you know, clearly adjustments had to be made along the way in order to continue prospering.
And was there ever a time where, just by the sheer volume and size, you know, and the responsibility that comes with the, you know, the large employee base and you know, the impact even that you make on the local community, that you were sort of forced into thinking about things more from the, you know, the macro or from the, you know, the community or the, you know, even local economy standpoint? And I would assume that those sorts of things, you know, would translate into your work on the different boards. Or were you actually able just to go the whole way, just straight on solid execution?
Well, you know, execution alone does not a competitor make. You have to do a lot of other things in terms of how you position the company strategically, how you see the future evolving, and the kind of bets you're going to make today and whether they'll pay off tomorrow. So should we do this acquisition? Should we expand into Europe? That entails great costs and risk, but maybe it's a necessary step for us to take to ensure the long-term health. So it wasn't just about execute, 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 scale, scale, scale. after a while, we had to make some very hard decisions about who we wanted to be 3, 4, 5 years from now. Did we want to be local? Did we want to be niche oriented? Did we want to be global? Did we want to be broad assortment kind of commodity supplier, which is ultimately what we chose to do.
And can you kind of walk through that decision process and sort of the elements and how you weighted the elements in making those choices?
Well, it was really a series of decisions made over the course of time based on, you know, how we saw the market evolving. I think the first phase of our development, if you broke it into different phases, okay, the first thing I already talked about, we changed models, so retail to wholesale. The next thing we did was, let's go acquire some more product lines. So I'd visit the customers. They're selling Amdek monitors and Epson printers and Apple computers. And which of these products can we earn the right franchise to distribute? And maybe they'll buy from us instead of Micro America or Ingram or one of the competitors out there. So that was kind of phase one. And then the next phase was, how do we expand geographically into the U.S.? Because there's clearly a lot of demand out there that we could supply. We had a model that appeared to be pretty cost efficient, very telemarketing oriented, centralized administration, sales, back office, and it was working. We were executing really well. So then the next step of our evolution was, okay, let's expand geographically, but what should that look like? You know, do we open offices? Do we open branches? Do we just put some feet on the street? Do we need warehouses? So we made some decisions around that based on some study and analytics that turned out to be the right bets. Then we had a whole set of competitors that were selling the most important product lines like Apple and Compaq and HP. We couldn't get our hands on that. But we kept pounding on the door and pointing out the capabilities we had versus their traditional kind of closed distribution model. And when they decided to open things up, we were there. And on and on and on it went. But I think the next big move for us was the decision to go global, essentially. And we did that through a series, mostly of acquisitions, a little bit of organic growth, but, you know, had stubbed our toe along the way, had some great successes, probably kind of a mixed bag in terms of results during my time. And my successors at this point, I think, did a much better job at running a big global corporation than I was capable of doing at the time.
Tech Data was always a strong partner to the resellers, and you're very pragmatic. And I think the reputation that Tech Data had was that of fair, pragmatic. Can you talk about the culture? I mean, the culture obviously emanated from you and your father, but as you grew and made acquisitions of other people's cultures, how much did culture play into those conversations and what did you do to sculpt that?
Well, I think there's probably several different dimensions. And the first would be always to insist on integrity and transparency in everything that we do, whether it's dealing with our board, our investors, our employees, our customers. If we had issues, we were front and center with it. When we described our capabilities, we were very, let's say, conservative and tried to be accurate and not overpromise. You know, the classic thing, you underpromise, overdeliver. I think that was very embedded in our culture. And then I think the overall kind of rhythm of the place was about operational excellence. And we just focused on that because it was a business of basis points. There wasn't a lot of inventing going on. It was really, how can we take out 5 more basis points? How can we remix our business to improve the margin yield overall? And all of that required today would be a lot more in the way of kind of big data analytics. We did a pretty good job of it at the time. And then also identifying additional services. But so I think it was really transparency, integrity, teamwork, and execution.
Wonderful. One of the biggest stretches to culture and just an organization in general has come through acquisitions and especially large acquisitions. You made a very large acquisition, Computer 2000. Mm-hmm. What are the lessons learned or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it was a huge acquisition, almost a merger, because at the time their revenue was, might have been pretty close to what ours was, you know, in the $5-7 billion range. We might have been a little larger and somewhat more profitable. And although it wasn't a hostile takeover, we did not enjoy the support of the senior management team, which was primarily German based in Munich. The shareholders were eager to sell it and monetize their investment, but the management team really thought of themselves as being the potential suitor, not the target. So we kind of had to get over that. And in the end, you know, several of the top guys left. And behind them, in a few areas, we had to kind of sweep up a little bit of a mess. So it took us, you know, a few years to get everything squared away. And ultimately, it paid off for us, but not without a few bumps in the road along the way. And I think we should have paid more attention to these cultural issues and understanding what the local people really wanted, how they wanted to see their career and the business evolve, and work more collaboratively with them to help align you know, our two approaches.
And there's two separate challenges there. One is getting the upper management on board, which may have never happened. But then beyond that, it's sort of the more logistical, you know, connecting with the employees of the company. And so when you talk about things you might have done differently, it would have been that more of that second one to really dig into getting them on board.
Well, I actually think we did quite a bit in that regard. I think it was really working probably closer with the country managers on both finance and operating side in a way so that we could bypass some of the senior management team, particularly when it was unstable.
Right.
So we could have probably done more to forge closer links there. Again, mergers are difficult. Cross-border mergers are even more difficult. And to make it even worse, it was a merger with a reluctant partner on the other side. So, you know, looking at it from my perspective now, I'm not sure that we would have done it because it ended up being a lot more work and pain than we anticipated. In the end, it all worked out.
Right.
But it was hard.
It was hard. And so, you know, when you have reluctant absorbees, they, you know, and sabotage is a strong word, but just, you know, being a weight, sort of not supporting change, doing, you know, just spreading a little bit of poison into the culture. Were you too kind about that? Or is that one place you would have been a little more aggressive to stamp that out in hindsight?
I think in hindsight, if I were to do it again and actually go through with the acquisition, we would have done more work in identifying the talent pool, grooming, developing kind of the replacement senior managers, and tried to move more quickly and proactively to remove the team that wasn't in support of the deal,
right?
You know, that were sort of passive resistors to it, and just get them out, because I think you're right, they are toxic to the culture.
Let's turn to Tampa Bay. You exited Tech Data very successfully, and you've chosen to live and stay here and be a part of this community on the board of Jabil. You know, since you retired, it's been about 12, 13 years now since you stepped out of Tech Data.
Mm-hmm.
How have you seen the Tampa Bay ecosystem change? What do you love? What do you think we need more of? What's sort of your state of the Bay?
Well, I like living here. And I like it more now than I used to, frankly, 10 or 15 years ago, because the area has changed. It's grown more cosmopolitan. There's more entertainment options, better dining options, more interesting people moving in. So we're attracting a lot of talent and cool people from other places. So it really has a different personality today than 15 years ago. I like all of that a lot. And I'm happy to live here and call it my home. You know, the flip side is that I don't think the area is really keeping up with the growth. I purposely live in an area and have an office where I can get there very quickly and easily, but I hate going north of, say, Park Boulevard, let alone Almerton, or crossing the bridges, because that's going to be my day. You know, it's sort of, I have to plan around the traffic, and it really shouldn't be that way. You know, I don't think we have the right leadership or something in the overall Bay Area, or maybe there's not the sufficient support at the grassroots level by the population. But what's really missing here is some vision around mass transit and starting to build a long-term plan. I think we're the only large metropolitan area without surface rail, for example, out of all the others. I mean, they have it in Texas, they have it in Phoenix, they have it in Denver, they have it all over the place in more modern sort of spread out cities. They're still making those investments. And I personally have invested quite a bit in real estate development in Charlotte, which has a very successful light rail system there. And a lot of the new development is taking place around the stops and the hubs. So you're getting more density, more clustered. So we need to be doing, thinking like that here. I think the other area is, and I don't know what the solution is, but I hear particularly in Hillsborough County, the school system is kind of on its heels. It's very poor and not keeping up with the demands, particularly of high-tech companies that need to have access to higher quality talent.
And you mentioned investing in Charlotte. What are some of the things, both in, you know, maybe real estate, but more in the lines of startups or young companies here, that, you know, what's been your sort of philosophy on investing in those types of things?
I haven't done much. I've done a couple small things like Florida Funders, which is as much as anything to be a good sport, to try to, you know, be a resource and help the tech community here develop. But it's not been a real priority for me. I've done quite a bit in philanthropy, quite a bit, again, with the corporations, including I was on the board for a couple of years at ConnectWise, which was, you know, arguably one of the most successful technology companies we've seen grow here in Tampa Bay, and with a very successful exit about a year ago, selling the company to Tomer Brav, and then now another exit for Tech Data going to private equity. So I really haven't been that involved with kind of the tech startup community, more larger corporations and community stuff,
right? So, you know, when you mentioned being a resource, one of the things I think is interesting in Tampa Bay, you being the leader of one of these successes that you grew from a modest company up to a juggernaut, there are not many of those. And so you're sort of forced into a business celebrity status here, right? You're in demand. We saw you at TyCon last year. You're here now. So, you know, coming from just, you know, a guy who grew his business up to that, how have you found that experience? Have you been able to largely make it what you want to make it, or how have you experienced that?
Well, I think it is worthwhile to point out that I don't spend a lot of time on these kinds of efforts. I don't get calls every week asking that I appear on some panel or participate in some program. Occasionally I get a call, and if I have time, I like to help out. It's fun. It comes, maybe falls under the rubric of giving back. Mm-hmm. You know, because most of these things I do, it's not for money. You know, when I go to TyCon, I'm not going to get anything at all out of it personally, other than try to be helpful to other young entrepreneurs, which for me, and also for, I know, other people in my situation, they find very rewarding.
I thought you gave some great insight at that event. So let's dig then in. It seemed like the area that you had the most energy in what you've done is in the philanthropy. So what's sort of your philosophy of giving, and where do you like to plug in there?
Generally, where I have been giving, you know, it's a reasonable amount of money, I suppose, for, you know, my overall balance sheet, if you will. But it's not massive. It's, you know, it's not the Gates Foundation by about a gazillion miles. So I tend to focus more on the local community or those institutions in which I have some personal knowledge or involvement. So, you know, I've given to ShoreQuest because my kids went there. I've given to the Dalí, you know, because I'm on the board there. I've given to All Children's Hospital because I serve on the board there. So I personally touch these organizations. I know the senior management. I have confidence in their competence and their ability to use my money and other financial support they're receiving effectively and responsibly.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. And that sort of leads into the idea of legacy. Do you place much value in legacy? And if so, how would you feel about yours now? And is there, you know, any adjustments or motivation to do anything different than what's happened thus far?
To be honest, I don't really think about it very much. I just try to live my life day to day and be nice to people, have fun, behave, get some things done.
How hard is it to behave?
Sometimes that's a hard part. Now, generally, it's gotten easier as I've gotten older. So I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about the legacy that I'm leaving behind, frankly. It actually has no meaning in my day-to-day life.
So if not legacy, which I respect that, I think that's, you know, living for yourself and living, you know, each day for yourself. Let's call it purpose.
I should admit, though, when I do drive by the Tech Data building, I'm, you know, I do, my chest does puff up a little bit. And when people say, wow, that's such a great company, yeah, I feel a little bit of pride, but I try to leaven it with humility and realize it doesn't really matter in terms of how I live my life today.
Sure. It is rare that a lot of companies get their launch pad or become the rocket ship, a lot of times out of luck, a lot of times out of right time, right place. You know, and obviously you had some elements of all of that, but it really feels like you're one of the few companies I can put my finger on that literally just did good business and grinded it out and just grew through sheer execution, through good decisions, through dotting your I's and crossing your T's. And, you know, I think that's rare. And a lot of these times you get stuck in the sort of survivorship bias, looking at a company that made it and looking back and attributing some magic to the choices that they made. But when I do that with Tech Data, I legitimately believe in the choices that you made.
Well, I think we were always focused on our customer first and foremost and organized most of our efforts and strategies around how do we serve them better and how can we do it more efficiently, because the margin pressure was unrelenting. So you had to figure out ways to make money in a marketplace that was very commodity driven in terms of the pricing power that we had, which was nil.
Right.
I mean, it was like selling weed on the market. Price was the price.
Yep.
And so you had to kind of look inside the company as to how you could still be competitive.
Right.
The next thing I would note is that, you know, in a company in the course of its life, the management team has to make a lot of decisions, and they're successful if maybe 55% of them are good. But I can talk all day and all night about all the bad decisions we made and missed opportunities as well. It happens that we got a few of the important things right. And we had a great team. So even when we maybe miscalculated or didn't make the best choice, like I was talking about our acquisition in Europe, you know, maybe not perfectly conceived, but we had a really good team. We were able to sort of grind through it, persevere, and come out the other end very successfully.
I would say that a lot of companies focus on customer, you know, maybe not to the degree, and maybe they don't do it as seriously and for real, but I think some of them do. Everybody says it. So it's more than just that. There's something in there beyond.
Well, it was a fun business because it was all repeat. So everybody you were doing with business with today, you know, if things went well, you're going to be doing business with them tomorrow and the next day and so on forever. So you had to have a real partnership mindset for both our customers we were selling to, but in some ways, more importantly, with our vendors, because without the vendors, we were out of business, especially with the kind of concentration with HP, Cisco, Apple, Microsoft, companies like this were huge. They didn't need to use our services. So it was incumbent upon us all the time to court them, remind them about the value we were providing,
right,
look for better opportunities, new opportunities to partner with them and help them develop their marketplace so we could be a real value-added service for them. So we knew where we sat in the food chain. And, you know, it was not the strongest place. It was a good place, but you had to be smart, had to be astute about how to exercise what little bit of power you might have there sitting in the middle of the value chain in ways that could create value for us and also deliver value to our partners.
And sort of riffing back on culture a little bit, when you have a, to your point, a commodity price sort of control in play, and you turn inside, I mean, that's really just efficiency and to some extent cost cutting. And I think that's also a little bit of the magic, because I think a lot of companies that define themselves in that position, you know, the culture and the actual day-to-day living at the business can get really, really thin really quickly because of that. You know, if the pressure is constantly on saving money, you know, that's ultimately lower salaries, less XYZ, anything that costs money becomes the enemy, because that's the only way to increase your profits.
Yeah.
And to navigate that is, you know, in a way that keeps the culture positive and lets it thrive and keeps the partnerships positive, I think is a little bit of the magic.
That's all very true. And we had to focus nonstop on cost and what we could do to lean out the operation, become more efficient, improve our revenue per head. And we did that very successfully. I think we're successful because we stayed humble. We were never the biggest company in the business. We were never the go-to one, you know, sort of the 900-pound gorilla. We always felt like we were catching up in the early days to lots of leaders that were ahead of us. And then later on, there were other companies, primarily, say, in Ingram, that was larger than we were. And they had a reputation as being rather full of themselves because they were so much bigger than everybody else. So we remained very humble, always looking for opportunities with our, particularly suppliers, to find ways we could partner with them to help them develop their market share or their opportunities. We're very, very attuned to that. So I think part of it actually is because the legacy of my dad's business, where he was a manufacturer's rep. So his customers, in many respects, were his suppliers, what he would call his principals. And he pandered to them as he needed to. And I took a lesson from that experience and realized that to be successful, we had to make sure that Apple saw us as a really value-added extension of their sales and marketing effort. And the same with HP and all the other vendors.
I think I cut you off a little bit. We were talking about legacy, and I was actually transitioning that into purpose, which I think is maybe a more fitting noun to use or whatever. So, and I ask this from the sense that you're a thinking person, clearly. You have been successful. You have the means to do whatever you want. And so that puts you in a unique position to have, you know, an access to meaning that others may not. And so that's sort of the lens with which I'm asking you, having gone through all of that, where did your purpose end up?
Well, it's a little paradoxical, actually, because, you know, I know a lot of rich people and I know a lot of poor people, and I can't really say there's a one-to-one correlation between money and happiness. In fact, sometimes it's the opposite. Too much money, people don't know what to do with themselves. They're already successful. How can they prove themselves? Where can they find meaning? In a lot of ways, it's more fun to build a business towards success rather than actually achieving it, because once you get there, people put their hands up and go, well, what do I do now? So that presents a different set of problems where there's an opportunity to kind of repurpose yourself and sort of re-engineer your brain and what gives you a sense of meaning in the world. And for me, that's a question of focusing more on family, friends, my community, and finding purpose in these kinds of connections and trying to help people.
Wonderful. So we end some of our shows with a shout out, and I'd be curious to hear who you think in the community that maybe is not getting as much attention as they should be, or maybe they are, but who do you think is doing well?
For me personally, and you know, in the last couple of years especially, I've continued to enjoy my association with Jabil. Mm-hmm. You know, it's become a huge company, fantastically successful, providing all kinds of great career opportunities for literally thousands of people in this area. And over the years, has also become a lot more high profile in terms of philanthropy. So I'm really quite proud to be associated with them.
Wonderful. Well, I've appreciated your time and thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
You've made it to the end of another great episode. For more SPX, visit stpx.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, CapEx Advisory Group, Build with Confidence. CapEx provides owners representation for the most demanding construction projects. With deep knowledge of design, finance, construction, and public policy, CapEx brings your project to life. CapEx supports your organization with leadership and expertise to reduce cost and ease the burden on your team. Discover what an owner's rep can do for you. Discover CapEx Advisory Group. Visit CEAG2.com. That's CEAG2.com.
2.com. And thanks also again to OPEN, the Open Partnership Education Network, which puts on great events around St. Petersburg, including Aresti speakers. To see the upcoming calendar of events, visit learnopen.org.